It is not often that a man becomes a legend in his own lifetime, but our speaker today is one of those historical rarities. The brilliance of his mind and the forcefulness of his personality clearly marked him early in his life as a man apart, destined to achieve towering heights of distinction in his profession. The military services have an apt phrase to describe such a man. He is born, they say, with stars on his shoulders. His exploits as a military commander are too well known to need recounting. They are written indelibly on the pages of American history and in the memories of those who served with him in Europe in World War I, and in World War II, in the Philippines, in the vast Pacific arena over which he exercised supreme command, in Japan, and finally in Korea. When the objective historians a century or two from now look back upon the turbulent first half of this century, I am confident that they will attribute to him the finest military mind of this era, and that he was supremely gifted both as a strategist and a leader of men capable of inspiring their unwavering loyalty and their warm affection. His fame is secure in the annals of our country's long history and that of the world. While his military success could be and was foreseen, it was not to be anticipated that he was greatly gifted in the field of civil government as well. And yet, it is a question whether he will be remembered best for his conquest of the Japanese Empire or for his superb work in building a new democratic nation from the wreckage of the empire he had destroyed. His was a task demanding courage, tact, diplomacy, persuasion, perseverance, and above all, unwavering loyalty to the principles of democratic government. We in America have reason to be forever grateful that those qualities were found combined in his person and were immediately available for application to the solution of a problem of unparalleled complexity. It's a great personal privilege to welcome General MacArthur to this university again, and to extend an equally warm and sincere welcome to Mrs. MacArthur, who is seated in the audience, and I wonder if she would rise so we might recognize her. Mrs. MacArthur, directly in front of me, halfway up in the stands. To also welcome General Courtney Whitney, the longtime military aide of General MacArthur. And General Whitney, will you rise so you may be recognized? In front of me on the grass. We are grateful to all of them for making the journey here to participate in this, our 101st commencement. It is with great pride that I present to the class of 1961, to our faculty, alumni, and friends, the Speaker of the Day, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur. General MacArthur.
President Hanna, and distinguished members and friends of this great university. As I was leaving New York this morning, a gentleman stopped me and said, General, June 11th is the 58th anniversary of your graduation from West Point. How does it feel being old? I answered that I liked it. And when he seemed surprised, I explained, with my date of birth in 1880, if I weren't old, I'd be dead. Graduation day reflects one of the great moments of life. In later years, when you have grown old, its memory will be watered by tears and coaxed and caressed by the smiles of yesterday. It marks the great dividing line between hope and destiny, between the dreams of fancy-free fantasy and the realization of the grim realities of adult responsibility. It marks the fulfillment of the first great task of life, the surmounting of the first great hurdle on the road to success. For youth, as it crosses the threshold of manhood, it has become a rallying point to build courage when courage seems to fail, to restore faith when there seems to be little cause for faith, to create hope when hope becomes forlorn. Unhappily, I possess neither that eloquence of diction, that poetry of imagination, nor that brilliance of metaphor to tell you members of the graduating class of 61 all that it means. But I can tell you some of the things your professors hope that your course of instruction has produced, in addition to the acquired knowledge and accumulation of facts that it necessarily accomplished. They hope above all else that it has been a builder of basic character, that it has molded you for your future roles as the custodians of the Republic, that it has taught you to be strong enough to know when you are weak and brave enough to face yourself when you are afraid. That it has taught you to be proud and unbending in honest failure, but humble and gentle in success. Not to substitute wishes for actions, not to seek the path of comfort, but to face the stress and spur of difficulty and challenge, to learn to stand up in the storm, but to feel compassion for those who fall, to have a heart that is clear, a goal that is high, to master yourself before you seek to master others, to learn to laugh, yet never forget how to weep, to reach into the future, yet never neglect the past, to be serious, yet never to take yourself too seriously, to be humble that you may always remember the simplicity of true greatness, the open mind of true wisdom, the meekness of true strength. That it has given you a temper of the will, a quality of the imagination, a vigor of the emotions, a freshness of the great springs of life, a temperamental predominance of courage over timidity, of an appetite for adventure over love of ease, that it has created in your heart the love of wonder, the undaunted challenge of events, the unfailing hope for what next, and the joy and the inspiration of life, that it has taught you in this way to be an American. And what, you might well ask, is this world which you now face? Since you were born, it has turned over many, many times. The thrust into outer space of the satellites, spheres, and missiles marked the beginning of a new epoch in the long story of mankind, the chapter of the space age. In the 5 or more billions of years the scientist tell it has taken to form the Earth, in the 3 or more billion years of development of the human race, there has never been a greater, a more staggering, or more abrupt evolution. We deal now not with things of this world only, but with the illimitable distances and as yet unfathomed mysteries of the universe. We have found the lost horizon. We have discovered a new and boundless frontier. We speak now in strange new terms of harnessing the cosmic energy, of making the winds and the tides work for us, of purifying sea water for our drink, of creating new and unheard of synthetic materials to supplement or even replace our old standard basics, of mining ocean floors for new fields of wealth and food, of controlling weather for a more equitable adjustment of heat and cold, of rain and shine, of disease preventatives to expand life into the 100 of years, of spaceships to the moon, of the prime target in war, no longer the armed forces of an enemy, but instead his civil population. Of ultimate conflict between a united human race and the sinister force of some other planetary galaxy. Of such dreams and fantasies as to make life the most exciting of all time. And how goes this life in this our own beloved country? two schools of thought exist. The one almost utopian in outlook, the other warning of dangers. The optimist, Alan Dury, says, this land, by the grace of God and the unceasing efforts of its people, is free. The first object of a free people should be the preservation of their liberty. This takes courage, as it at times tends towards governmental inefficiency. Some peoples have it, some people do not. The 20th century, most violent crucible yet provided for the human race, is rapidly finding out which is which. In that testing, our country, the great republic of the West, still stands supreme, battered though she is by the vicious and incessant onslaughts of her enemies and the occasional confusions and wearings of will by her own citizens. Her freedom is not perfect, but it is better than that of most of her contemporaries. Her liberties are not everywhere as thorough and complete as they should be. But compared to the grimly laughable mockeries of liberty that go on elsewhere, they shine like a tenfold beacon in the night. Our errors are those of the good-hearted. Our ineptitudes, those of a contender who cannot yet quite conceive of the utter evil arrayed against us. We are awkward at times, short-sighted at times, at times hesitant and uncertain, and almost willfully stupid. We are now and again an object of ridicule to a carping world, and upon occasion, an object of scorn. But we are free. There is nothing simple or easy in this freedom which so many people shout about and so few really understand. It is only in a few favored lands that it has ever been achieved. Ours is one. Yet, in deep warning, we hear the voice of one of our greatest statesmen, Senator Byrd. Continuing centralization of government is destroying our freedom and strength. We have already gone too far. With excessive centralization comes excessive central edict, regulation and taxation, limiting and drastically curtailing personal freedom. The requirements of free government are simple: honesty and individual initiative, self-reliance and willing work, constructive production and free competition, progressive development with sound financing. Without these, there will be neither solid progress nor security. We are being challenged from abroad and undermined at home. We are showing signs of weakness just when we should be strongest. Our strength is being sapped by deficit financing indulged in too long, federal paternalism grown too big, courts grown too mighty, power groups grown too arrogant. These are subverting our system, changing our attitudes, and hobbling our will for freedom. For 15 years, the United States has been the world's banker, the world's policeman, the world's Santa Claus. We are showing a strain, we're in a dangerous storm. And President Kennedy declared in his first address to Congress, before my term is ended, we shall have to test anew whether a nation organized and governed such as ours can endure. The outcome is by no means certain. And all this now becomes your problem. Our two great political parties will divide over you, over what you are, over what you ought to be, over what you can be. The one will preach citizen individuality, the other group collectivism, the one based on the individual, the other on the mass. If I were permitted but one word of advice to you young men and women now standing on the threshold of these challenging opportunities and responsibilities, it would be to hold inviolate the immutable principles upon which is rested our hallowed traditions of liberty and freedom. I realize well that it is in the very nature of things that the restless spirit of youth seeks change. But change should not be sought for the sake of change alone. It should be sought only to adapt those time-tested principles to the new requirements of an expanding society. For just as in war, strategy is immutable, while tactics must change to meet new field conditions, so in peace, basic principles, which have been proved in the crucible of human experience, should remain immutable while the administration for their application changes to meet the requirements of an ever-advancing civilization. The problem for ages has been to rescue liberty from the grasp of despotic power. The spirit of liberty, said one of our greatest past senators, Daniel Webster, should be bold and fearless, but it should also be cautious, sagacious, discriminating, far-sighted. It should be jealous of encroachment, jealous of power, jealous of man. It should demand checks. It should seek for guides. It should insist on securities. It should fortify itself with all possible care against the assaults of ambition and passion. It should not trust the amiable weaknesses of human nature and thereby permit power to overstep its prescribed limits, even though benevolence, good intent, and patriotic purpose come along with it. It should look before and after, and building on the experience of ages which are past, should labor diligently for the benefit of ages to come. And overshadowing all of the problems you will face, intruding upon every thought and action, encompassing all that you hold most dear, dictating not only the past but your very future, is the master problem of global war. How, you can well ask, did such an institution as war become so integrated with man's life and civilization? How has it grown to be the most vital factor in our existence? It started in a modest enough way as a sort of gladiatorial method of settling disputes between conflicting tribes. One of the oldest, most classical examples is the biblical story of David and Goliath. Each of the two contesting groups selected its champion. They fought, and based upon the outcome, an agreement resulted. Then, as time went on, Small professional groups, known as armies, replaced the individual champions. And these groups fought in some obscure corner of the world, and victory or defeat was accepted as the basis of an ensuing peace. From then on, down through the ages, the constant record is an increase in the character and strength of the forces, with the rate of increase always accelerating. From a small percentage of the population, it finally engulfed all. It is now the nation in arms. Within the span of my own life, I have witnessed much of this evolution. At the turn of the century, when I joined the Army, the target was one enemy casualty at the end of a rifle, a pistol, a banner, a sword. Then came the machine gun, designed to kill by the dozens. After that, the heavy artillery, raining death upon the hundreds. Then the aerial bomb, to strike by the thousands, followed by the atom explosion to reach the hundreds of thousands. Now electronics and other processes of science have raised the destructive potential to encompass millions. And with restless hands, we work feverishly in dark laboratories to find the means to destroy all at one blow. But this very triumph of scientific annihilation, this very success of invention, has destroyed the possibility of war being a medium for the practical settlement of international differences. The enormous destruction to both sides of closely matched opponents makes it impossible for even the winner to translate it into anything but his own disaster. The late war, even with its now antiquated armaments, clearly demonstrated that the victor had to bear in large part the very injuries inflicted on his foe. We expended billions of dollars and untold energies to heal the wounds of Germany and Japan. I know global war has become a Frankenstein to destroy both sides. No longer can it be a successful weapon of international adventure. If you lose, you are annihilated. If you win, you stand only to lose. No longer does it possess even the chance of the winner of a duel. It contains now only the germs of double suicide. Time was when victory in war represented a shortcut to power, a place in the sun, economic wealth, accelerated prosperity. It was the final weapon of statecraft, the apotheosis of diplomacy. Its application, however, was regulated, controlled, and limited by the basic principle that a great nation that entered upon war and did not see it through to victory would ultimately suffer all the consequences of defeat. That is what happened to us in Korea. With victory within our grasp, and without the use of the atom bomb, which we needed no more then than we did against Japan, we failed to see it through. Had we done so, we would have destroyed Red China's capability of waging modern war for generations to come. Our failure to win that war was a major disaster to the free world. Its fatal consequences are now increasingly being felt in the military rise of Red China into a mighty colossus which threatens all of continental Asia and bids fair to emerge as the balance of military power in the world. This would jeopardize freedom on all continents. But the conditions that prevailed in the Korean War exist no more and will never come again. Then we were the sole possessors of nuclear power. We stood alone in military might. Now all this has changed. Others possess this weapon. Relative strengths from now on will probably change little with the years. Action by one will promptly be matched by reaction from the other. The great question then is, can global war now be outlawed from the world? If so, it would mark the greatest advance in civilization since the Sermon on the Mount. It would lift at one stroke the darkest shadow which has engulfed mankind from the beginning. It would not only remove fear and bring security, it would not only create new moral and spiritual values, it would produce an economic wave of prosperity that would raise the world's standard of living beyond anything ever dreamed of by man. The hundreds of billions of dollars now spent in mutual preparedness could conceivably abolish poverty from the face of the earth. It would accomplish even more than this. It would, at one stroke, reduce the international tensions that seem to be insurmountable now to matters of probable solution. This would not, of course, mean the abandonment of all armed forces, but it would reduce them to the simpler problems of internal order and international police. It would not mean utopia at one fell stroke, but it would mean that the great roadblock now existing to the development of the human race would have been cleared. You will say at once that although the abolition of war has been the dream of man for centuries, every proposition to that end has been promptly discarded as impossible and fantastic. But that was before the science of the past decade made mass destruction a reality. The argument then was along spiritual and moral lines, and lost. But now, the tremendous evolution of nuclear and other potentials of destruction has suddenly taken the problem away from its primary consideration as a moral and spiritual question and brought it abreast of scientific realism. It is no longer an ethical equation to be pondered solely by learned philosophers and ecclesiastics, but a hardcore one for the decision of the masses whose survival is the issue. This is as true of the Soviet side of the world as of the free side, as true behind the Iron Curtain as in front of it. The ordinary people of the world, such as you and I, whether free or slave, are all in agreement on this solution. This, perhaps, is the only thing in the world they do agree upon, but it is the most vital and decisive of all. We are told that we must go on indefinitely as at present. With what at the end? None say. There is no definite objective. The search for a final solution is but passed along to those who follow. And at the end, the problem will be exactly that which we face now. It may take another cataclysm of destruction to prove the bald truth that the further evolution of civilization cannot take place until global war is abolished. This is the one issue upon which both sides can agree, or it is the one issue upon which both sides will profit equally. It is the one issue in which the interests of both are completely parallel. It is the one issue which, if settled, might settle all others. The present tensions, with their threat of national annihilation, are fostered by two great illusions. The one, a complete belief on the part of the Soviet world that the capitalistic countries are preparing to eventually attack them, that sooner or later we intend to strike. And the other, a complete belief on the part of the capitalistic countries that the Soviets are preparing to attack us, that sooner or later they intend to strike. Both are wrong. Each side, so far as the masses are concerned, is desirous of peace. Both dread war. But the constant acceleration of preparation may, without specific intent, ultimately precipitate a kind of spontaneous combustion. Many will tell you, with mockery and ridicule, that the abolition of war can be only a dream, that it is but the vague imaginings of a visionary. But we must go on, or we will go under. And criticism is that the world has no plan which will enable us to go on. We have suffered the blood and the sweat and the tears. Now we seek the way and the truth and the light. We are in a new era. The old methods and solutions to this vital problem no longer suffice. We must have new thoughts, new ideas, new concepts. We must break out of the straitjacket of the past. We must have sufficient imagination and moral courage to translate this universal wish, which is rapidly becoming a universal necessity, into actuality. And until then, whatever the cost or sacrifice, we must be fully prepared lest we perish. President Hanna, no award I've ever received moves me more deeply than to have my name scrolled upon the honorary tablets of this great university. Perhaps this is because I am informed that no institution of learning is more devotedly dedicating its full strength to the preservation of those fundamental principles upon which this nation was conceived and nurtured to greatness. None more ardently is resisting compromise with that free way of life we reverently call Americanism. None espouses more energetically that bulwark of national freedom, rugged individual thought and action. Please extend to all concerned my thanks and deepest appreciation. To you of 61 goes my hope that all good things may come to each and every one of you. And my prayer that a merciful God will protect and preserve you always. Goodbye.
The entire graduating class, the platform party, and all guests are standing in an ovation to General Douglas MacArthur.
General MacArthur, the generous and spontaneous applause on the part of this audience expresses their appreciation to you more adequately and effectively than any words that I might utter. We are grateful indeed to you, sir, for your willingness to come here and to deliver this eloquent and thoughtful address. Thank you, sir, very much.